Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today I get put on the spot. Cook and writer Kate Hayhoe gives me the Cook's Eco Test. What do I know about cooking green? Now, she's done the book Cooking Green, Reducing Your Carbon Footprint in the Kitchen. You know, I'd love to be a cheap date, but when it comes to buying me cheese, it's kind of tough because invariably the cheeses that I yearn for are artisan types and they're expensive. But why are they so expensive? Well, I go to cheese expert Steve Jenkins for the answers. Then it's the soups of summer. New York Times columnist Melissa Clark says that if you can make a smoothie, you can make a flock of cold soups. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
You know, Lynn, people know that Jane and Michael Stern are formidable eaters, and they often tell us about huge portions and all-you-can-eat places. And when we go to those places, you get a ton of food and it's not very good. Well, we found the grand exception. It's called Harold's New York Deli in Edison, New Jersey, where the portions are insanely huge, but it's probably, and I, you know, this is a lot to say, the best delicatessen in America.
Oh, come on.
No, really.
No, seriously. I mean, I was about
seriously. No, let us first say that Harold has served a long stint working at the Carnegie Deli in New York. So this guy knows
his
delis.
Okay. That's one of the Harvards of delicatessen.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I mean, this is the Ivy League of delis.
Yeah.
And this guy, I mean, the pastrami in this place, I would match this against any pastrami from Katz's, anywhere else. The blintzes, the matzo ball soup,
chicken in a pot. I mean, you know how we all have taste memories that, you know, we match everything against? Like, well, you know, this is a good blintz, but it's not as good as the blintz my grandmother made in 1957. Harold's New York Deli in Edison hit every single taste memory on the mark, from the best egg cream I have ever had to hot borscht, cold borscht, a pickle bar that is longer than the Queen Mary. I mean, it is incredibly good. Also, probably the last remaining good seeded rye bread in America.
First of all, you just say pickle bar. I mean, we're talking, because what I'm thinking of when I think New York Deli, it's those little green tomatoes that are pickled and the half sours, the full dills.
Right. They got the pickle chips. They got something called a health salad. Don't ask me why. It's cabbage, carrots.
It's like farmer's chop suey, they used to call it.
And the thing is, you go help. This is before your meal comes. You go help yourself to all the pickles, pickled tomatoes, health salad you want, plus a stack of rye bread and or pumpernickel.
But wait, we have to get to the main thing. Okay, we ordered matzo ball soup.
Right.
The matzo ball, and I have a big head. I'm one of these people who can't get a hat that fits. The matzo ball was bigger than my head. But wait.
If you rested your soup spoon on top of the matzo ball, mere gravity sent it floating down all the way to the bottom. It's that light.
And the chicken soup is that double stock, you know, the old style way of making.
Yeah.
Real chickeny.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a piece of cake you get for dessert at Harold's, which is 2 feet high.
Yeah, it's like a wedding cake, but it's just the cake.
It's a slice of cake. And Michael actually measured the pastrami sandwich, and it was 1.5 feet
18 inches tall.
You're joking.
No, I'm not joking.
Seriously.
No, wait. Let me just tell you. One day we had a beef brisket sandwich. I had the beef brisket. Jane had chicken in a pot. We took the leftovers from the beef brisket sandwich home. The next day we had corned beef hash for lunch. The next morning, we had beef hash for breakfast. So it was like three meals for two people.
Now, when you get to Harold's, the menu will just, you'll look at it and you go, what?
Yeah, because it's so expensive.
Yeah, it's like the blintzes are like $19 and the and the cake is $14 a slice. So you don't quite know what the heck is going on here. But this is not a place for dieters.
Or if you're going to eat singly all by yourself, unless you want to take home lots of leftovers, this is a place to go to with at least one other person, preferably three other people.
So you're saying that every $12 piece of cake serves four?
Exactly. Or
okay,
six.
Okay, I got it.
It's fabulous, Lynn. It's absolutely fabulous.
Oh, guys, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Gina Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you know the Sterns are here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you feel like it. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. You know, I'm dedicated to the proposition of cook once, eat many times. Sometimes it's the big chicken that you roast late at night when the temps come down, and then you eat off of it for days. Well, this week, it's been green beans and potatoes. On sale and looking like they were gathered an hour before. Now, you can't let this kind of prime stuff hang around. You have to stop the clock on it, cook it right away, and then you figure out what to do with it. So in the same pot of boiling water, I cooked the potatoes, scooped them out, then did the beans, and an idea hit. I kept the water, made some dumbed-down pesto, which is basically basil, garlic, and olive oil, and then I cooked pasta in the same water as the veggies. And for supper, we had a classic pasta with pesto, the way they do it in pesto's home territory of Genoa. That's with sliced potatoes and some green beans, tossed in with some grated cheese. The next night, some of the potatoes and green beans became a carnivore's salade niçoise. Oil and vinegar dressing on the potatoes, cold chicken, and the green beans with capers. On night three, we cashed in on leftovers and made a pasta omelet with the leftover pasta and some eggs. Let nothing escape your appetite. Oh, and by the way, you can find the recipe for an official pesto. I call it a classic pesto of Genoa right on the website, splendidtable.org. Think that we owe Steve Jenkins great thanks. I mean, he's one of the founding fathers of the artisan cheese movement. Steve is a cheesemonger or merchant. Now, three decades ago, when handmade cheeses were as rare as hen's teeth in American markets, Steve was hunting them down on both sides of the Atlantic and introducing us to them. Well, he's still at it with the Fairway Markets in New York City. Now, the reason why I say I think I owe Steve thanks is the money I am parting with to support my cheese habit. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you, Lynn.
Stephen, why are artisan cheeses so expensive?
They're not expensive. You are so wrong about that. If you'll think about it, you know, an artisan cheese is not $3.99 anymore. That's Danish cheese that nobody wants to eat. An artisan cheese is going to be, you know, from $16 to even $24 a pound. Okay, big deal. A quarter pound of that, $6. You're going to spend $6 on yourself for a quarter pound of cheese. Well, you have no problem buying a $20 bottle of wine, and you're going to drink half of it. That costs you $10. So you think it's okay to spend twice as much on the beverage as you do on the cheese? I think cheese and olive oil are among the greatest values in this life, not just any tangible thing or any edible substance, but everything in the universe. Artisan cheeses are still the best value there is. So you have to spend $6 on yourself. In 10 years, you'll have gotten over it.
Does that money actually go to the cheesemaker, or is that money... Does that go along the chain of all the people that handle that cheese before it gets to you? Is the cheesemaker really making money on this?
The cheesemaker is doing this as a hobby. The cheesemaker is not making any money, and the cheesemaker is not going to get rich making cheese, no matter how successful he or she is. That money goes for the enormous upkeep of all that land and all those animals and all that equipment and all that time and effort. Mm-hmm. And it is bupkis compared to what so many winemakers make that are able to market themselves as something that is worth you spending $20, $30, $40, $50, $60 on a bottle that you're going to share with two other people, and it's gone. That seems to be okay. But the cheesemaker, I don't know. Americans are so inured to spending $3.99, $4.99 for some Scandinavian cheese that's so eminently forgettable that it doesn't deserve a place at the table. An artisan cheese is handmade by people from animals that have been coddled. If it costs $16 a pound, $22 a pound, so be it. It's worth two or three times that much.
Well, the other thing is, I must say, a few bites of cheese is incredibly satiating, more so than a few bites of many things. But I guess the other thing is, from where you stand, are there any bargains out there in artisan-made cheeses?
Absolutely. The cheddars in this country from not just Vermont, but California and New York State and all around are an extraordinary value. These are cheeses that have been aged 2, 3, and 4 years, which really adds a great financial burden to the cheesemaker. Mm-hmm. But they're still selling for below $10 a pound. They're an absolute steal, these cheddars. And the blue cheeses as well. For instance, at the Rogue Creamery out in Oregon, the magnificent blue cheeses, the likes of which are only found in England and Italy and France and parts of Spain. These are magnificent blue cheeses that sell for about half of what their imported versions sell for. So there are great blue cheeses in this country that are a ridiculous price. I can't believe that they're mm-hmm. able to charge so little money for them.
Well, this is good. Now we've got something we know to look for.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
My pleasure.
Steve Jenkins is author of The Food Life, Inside the World of Food with the Grocer Extraordinaire at Fareway. Find Steve's cheese suggestions on our website, splendidtable.org. And on that very same site are all sorts of other opportunities. Check out our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to make your worknight cooking easier with a new recipe each week, along with tips, deathless pros, and assorted discoveries. There's our podcast and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Coming up, greening up the kitchen for wee cheapskates and instant summer soups. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. As if our wallets, our jobs, or the lack thereof, our waistlines, and our worries over where our foods come from isn't enough, now we have got to change our lives to save the planet. You know, I'm tired of hearing, to be green, I have to build a new kitchen. I want to know what I can do with what I've got, because buying new is not going to happen. Well, food writer Kate Hayhoe is the proverbial breath of fresh air here. Her take is work with what you've got, and it's in her book, Cooking Green, Reducing Your Carbon Footprint in the Kitchen, The New Green Basics Way. Kate, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kate, what should people be thinking about as they look at this issue of being green in the kitchen?
Well, you know, we want to work with the materials that we have. You know, going out and buying something new doesn't necessarily help you shrink your footprint. And your footprint is really the entire chain of resources used to create the foods you eat and the waste produced in the process. So it starts in the field and the farm, and it goes to the factory, and it goes to your grocery store and a refrigerated truck mm-hmm. maybe, and then it gets to your home and your pantry, and it includes the materials that you use, what you cook with, the materials that your kitchen is made of, your appliances, large and small. So all of that is incorporated into your footprint. And it's really just a way of thinking about your impact with every bite you take. And remember that even though you may not cook, someone cooks the food for you, and that's part of your footprint. It's all about the choices that you make.
Well, okay, I'd like you to check me out about how green I actually am.
Okay, well, we've got a quiz in the book that has to do with shrinking your cookbook and knowing how what your impact is. So let's start with the refrigerator, which is the kitchen's biggest energy hog. It eats up 11% of the entire home's electricity. So what, Len, is the optimum temperature for your refrigerator?
38 or so degrees.
Bing, you win. If you keep it between 37 to 40 degrees, you're in the safe range. And 38 is, I agree with you, probably the best, because meats do best between 31 and 36 degrees. Mm-hmm. Dairy products do best between 33 and 38 degrees. And fruits and vegetables are good between 35 and 40. So 38 is great. And then you can spot chill certain areas. For instance, to keep meats down around the 31 degree level, what I do is I put them in the meat bin. And then I toss in some of those blue freezer packs, you know, you take on picnics and stuff.
Well, that's a great idea.
Yeah, and it drops the temperature down just low enough to extend their freshness another 2 or 3 days, which means you don't have to go to the grocery store and use fuel to get there as often.
Okay, all right, I'm on a roll. Another question.
Okay. Which of these grains requires the least energy to cook at home? Basmati rice, medium grind bulgur wheat, or quinoa?
That one's easy. It's the bulgur wheat.
Yes, and you know why, Lynn, right?
Well, the bulgur wheat is already cooked, so all you're really doing is essentially rehydrating it. It's like couscous.
That's right. Yeah, it's processed that way. So you just pour boiling water over it and let it steam for a few minutes. Whereas with rice and quinoa, you need to actually boil them or cook them in, you know, with actual flame under the pot for a while.
Kate, I've got one more question for you. You have a method in the book for cooking pasta that I must say had my Italian ancestors flipping in their graves.
Okay, yes. Part of the book deals with cutting back on the amount of fuel you use when you cook something. For instance, with an oven, you can start things in a cold oven rather than preheating them, lasagna, for instance. And with lasagna, you can turn the fuel off early, say 15 or 20 minutes early, and the residual heat will continue to cook the food. You can do the same thing with a pot of water, because water takes a long time to cool down. And what you're talking about is the way I cook pasta is I bring the water to a boil. I put my spaghetti in there, for instance.
Right.
Let it boil for 2 minutes, just as you would normally, and then I turn the flame off and I leave it covered for about the same amount of time that it would take normally to cook with the flame being active, and it comes out perfectly tender and al dente without burning extra fuel for that last, you know, 7 minutes or something like that.
Well, I'm going home and I'm going to put on that pot of boiling water and I'm going to check this one out.
Please do. Please do. And, you know, the thing is, it applies not just to pasta, but, say, blanching vegetables. Because one of the things that happens is you end up with a more gentle heat at the end. So you have less risk of a boiling over and you have less risk of overcooking as well.
It does make sense. I'm teasing you about it, but it does make sense. And I'm going to try this one out. Kate, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Food writer Kate Hayhoe is author of Cooking Green, Reducing Your Carbon Footprint in the Kitchen. Now, you can find Kate's controversial recipe for feta pesto and two-minute pasta on the website splendidtable.org. How you read some people's recipes and you feel like you know them. You share similar tastes and maybe a similar lustiness. Well, that's the way I feel whenever I read A Good Appetite. It's Melissa Clark's column in the New York Times, and she's in the studio. Hey, Melissa, welcome.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, what do you cook in this heat?
I do not cook in this heat. That's the secret. I try to do as little cooking as possible.
Uh-huh.
And one of my favorite secret recipes is to make soups in the blender. It's like making a smoothie, except that it's savory and you can serve it to your family for dinner and they think it's fabulous. And it's so easy, Lynn. It's just the best thing ever. Cold blender soups.
So what kinds of things do you do?
Well, everybody knows about gazpacho. I think right. that is that's the blender, the cold blender soup that's kind of made it into the mainstream. You know, I think when people think about soup, they think hot soup, they think winter, they think snow outside, except for gazpacho, which is the soup, the cold soup that's made it into the big time. And so gazpacho is a very big part of my summer repertoire. I use gorgeous tomatoes in the summer. And then you can also use green grapes or red grapes leading into the fall when it's still warm out and you still want to have a cold soup. When I think about cold soups, I think about three different categories of soup. There are three different ways that I like to approach, you know, putting things into the blender. Mm-hmm. The first is gazpacho, which I consider all soups that have a juicy, rich vegetable as a base. So what I like to do is, I take this base, whatever the vegetable is going to be or the fruit. So in this case, let's say for a classic gazpacho, we're going to use gorgeous August tomatoes or,
right.
you know, the juiciest ones you can find. And that is going to be the bulk of what I'm putting in the blender. And then all it is a matter of seasoning. And so you use a little bit of garlic, a little bit of onion, and then the secret is enough vinegar to kind of set off the tomato, because you know how sweet and rich tomato is.
Yeah,
you want a little vinegar for complexity, salt and olive oil. And then you just press go, and it, you know, 5 minutes later or 5 seconds later, you've got this gorgeous red soup that everybody is going to go crazy for. So that's the first category, is these rich, juicy soups. Then people always think about cream soups as
right.
being something warm, but you can use cream or yogurt or buttermilk as a cold soup. And that is another whole classification of cold soups, because you're using that as the base. That's going to be, you know, the liquidy part. And then you can put anything you want into that to season it. You can make a buttermilk soup. In fact, I did this, I guess it was last summer. I made a buttermilk soup with just fresh herbs. I took all the herbs that, you know, in my pots on my deck.
Uh-huh.
I gathered them up. I pureed them with lots of garlic, and then I put a little bit of almond in there to thicken it. And I blended the whole thing together, and I had this gorgeous herb buttermilk soup with garlic. And it was basically from stuff I had around.
It's sort of a takeoff on ranch dressing.
Oh, my God, you're so right. It's exactly what it is.
Don't
you want to just eat ranch dressing with a spoon? Come on.
What do you mean, want to?
Exactly.
I love it.
You know, and I add ice cubes in that as well, and that thins it down, so it's perfect.
You know, I've done that kind of thing with yogurt, but it never occurred to me to do it with buttermilk.
You can do it with yogurt. It's just as delicious.
So you said there were three basics. So we've got the we've got the juicy
exactly fruit vegetable,
the milky,
and then the left. Yep, the milky, the creamy milky, which is really nice when you want to serve something a little bit elegant. I think that is a really elegant presentation. And then the last one is to use just chicken broth or vegetable broth or water as your base. Then you can add vegetables. You can add bread. You can add stale bread, and you can create a soup that's going to be kind of like a gazpacho. It's going to showcase the vegetables, but it's mm-hmm. going to be a little bit more soupy. It's going to be more liquidy. And chicken broth is my favorite. And I think, I don't know, most people don't think to just put chicken broth in the blender. They think they have to heat it first, but you don't. You can buy chicken broth in those containers and just pour it into the blender with one of my favorite things, beets, to make a borscht, a summer borscht that you don't have to cook. And this is a recipe that I have been making for years. It's just a classic for me and for my family. You can buy beets that are already cooked in, they come vacuum packed.
Yeah.
So you don't have to do anything. You buy these vacuum packed beets, you slice them up, garlic, a little bit of onion, and then dill gives it a really nice sort of borscht-y flavor.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's that like Eastern European flavor. Throw it all in the blender with chicken stock, and people will think you actually simmered this for hours, then cooled it down, and then served it, and you've done it. It's like making a smoothie. It is so easy and so good. And a plop of sour cream or creme fraiche in the middle, and it's this just sustaining, very rich-flavored, cold, but, you know, filling dinner that you can serve. It's on a summer evening, and it's just perfect. Or for lunch, it's terrific for lunch.
Melissa, that is so great. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Cookbook author Melissa Clark's column, A Good Appetite, appears every week in the New York Times. Now, you can find that borscht recipe she talked about on the website, splendidtable.org. It is time for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Now, first up, We have our final winner, our gastrosexual for the month of July. Now, if you're clueless about this gastrosexual thing, here are the cliff notes. A new word turned up in England, gastrosexual, defined as a person who uses their cooking skills to create romance with others. To not dance around the issue, we are talking seduction with food. Well, this had contest written all over it, so we put our deeply insightful questionnaire up on the website and said, let the games begin. Well, our last gastrosexual, that is the winner for the month of July, is Trey from Washington, D.C., and we've got Trey on the phone. Hey, Trey, congratulations.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am good. Well, now, as our official winner, America wants to know, what was your greatest all-time, in quotes, success dish?
I would say, and I've gotten a good response from this, it's my one-pound caramel ice cream. And I just make a very traditional custard base. And as the custard is freezing in my machine,
yeah,
I pour in 1 pound of cold caramel, like caramel
syrup
that you make on the stove with heavy whipping cream.
Holy
And then I
cow.
Pour that into my custard base, which is, you can you can really only have about 2 or 3 spoons full.
And you say you've actually test-driven this.
Yes. I was bored one day, and I made this beautiful ice cream, and I brought it down to my significant other, and I asked her to close her eyes, and I put the spoon in her mouth, and I turned the spoon upside down and pulled it out.
Uh-uh.
And I don't think she moved for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's definitely the final test, isn't it?
Certainly.
Well, let's talk about the meal of your dreams. Because we asked you what would be the ultimate dinner that you might serve as a gastrosexual, the setting, the ambiance, as well as the food. So why don't you tell us what it was?
Well, my ideal meal would be out in a field about 30 minutes before the sun really starts to go down, to set.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And I would just have an old fire pit, a cast iron pan, an old-school hand-churn ice cream maker, and I would serve really whatever the market gave me. At the time, I filled out the application. We were getting beautiful squash from Northern Virginia, so I would make, like, roasted squash soup or something like that, and we'd get beautiful scallops at the beginning of the summer. So I would do roasted scallops and spring onions, and it's, you know, you're kind of sitting in the middle of Mother Nature, and there's really nothing sexier than that.
Do you have what you might call a food philosophy? I don't necessarily mean as a cook, but where did this all come from for you? Is it your family, or is it just something that you feel is instinctual for you, this great delight in food?
It's been a long time coming. There's a story about when my sister was turned 3, my grandfather built her a wooden kitchen in his shop behind his house, and he brought it to her, and she had no interest whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But the very next morning, my mom said she found me playing with, I had pulled her pots and pans off of the stove and put them on that wooden kitchen, and I was going to town. You know, you could always find me at the heel of one of my grandmothers in their kitchen. You know, the kitchen table was always a great place. It was always buzzing, people running around, and it's where I knew I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
My love developed from there.
Well, hey, Trey, thanks so much for taking part in the contest, and congratulations. I wish we could offer you some spectacular prize, but what we can offer you is official Splendid Table bragging rights.
That sounds wonderful to me. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, thank you, sir.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. That was Trey from Washington, D.C., our July Gastrosexual of the Month. And great thanks to everybody who took part in our contest. You're all great gastrosexuals. Call us, guys. Number's 800-537-5252. Anything goes. We have got Steve calling from Baltimore. Hey, Steve, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn, how are you doing?
I am doing just swell.
I've learned so much from your show, and I try to listen every week. And I guess about a month or so ago, you were talking you started talking about a spice with a food, and it got me to thinking. You know, I have a few can't-miss marriages of a spice with a food. Let's say like rosemary with lamb,
right.
Basil with tomato,
right.
Caraway with cabbage. And I was wondering what your favorite marriages of a spice with a specific food were.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. All right. For me, I'll tell you, I've got a couple. For instance, lime juice and lime zest, okay, with fresh ginger, garlic, and chili. It's pure Southeast Asian, but that combination then with almost anything like chicken, fish. If I take that, the lime juice, I throw a little oil in there and I marinate chicken thighs in that, you know, mm-hmm. for several hours or overnight, and then put it on a slow grill or just slow cook it anyway, you know, so it's crispy and it's slow cooked, but it's going to be start to brown on the outside. To me, that's fabulous. Another combination, again, going back to the citrus, lemon with rosemary or sage. And that with lamb, with pork, with poultry is fabulous. But that combination with eggplant, you rub it on the eggplant and you also have a little bit of olive oil. And then again, grill it slow, grill, you know, maybe half inch thick slices of eggplant with that you've seasoned with that. Out of this world.
Well, that's going to happen soon because I've got lots of good eggplant in my garden. So that will be happening very soon.
And you know, the other thing is that combination on raw tomato, you know, just a sliced mm-hmm. tomato salad with a little olive oil. It is so good. And a little lemon juice. People never think of lemon with tomato. And it's a really interesting combination.
Mm-hmm.
And chili and garlic are a natural marriage. They just like each other a lot.
Okay.
If you do those two together, all right, and you throw some cumin and coriander in that,
mm-hmm.
either fresh coriander or dry. They're two different flavors, but both of them work. Now, when you do those three together, you can be either in North Africa, in the Middle East, or in Mexico. And you might even be in southern India. You see what I'm... You see,
absolutely.
Am I confusing you with this? Because
no, absolutely. I'm going to divert some of my lime juice from my mojitos into that mixture you just talked about.
I wouldn't give up on the mojitos.
No, no, I won't give up, but I'll divert some.
Yeah.
And we'll go from there.
Hey, Steve, thank you. And
hey,
you take care.
Bye.
Bye. All right, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is for lovers of words. If someone presented you with an off-McGandy, what would you get? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, this question was for lovers of words. If someone presented you with an off-McGandy, what would you get? Well, you'd get the best and choicest of delicacies, or in today's language, totally awesome food. Now, if you ask for off-McGandy in the days when the word was common language, which was in the 1700s in England, you might be presented with a pulpitoon, a pie, and a doozy, overkill at its best. The crust was a mix of pounded mushrooms, marrow, oysters, veal, sweetbreads, and spices that enclosed a small flock of roasted pigeons. And it was a very big deal in the court of Queen Anne. So, you thought that turducken was special? Okay, back to the phones. And your calls reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up next? We have got Jane on the line from Portland, Oregon. Jane, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about something that my family enjoyed on a vacation that we took last summer to Tuscany.
Uh-huh.
And it was at a little restaurant where we had an antipasti plate, and they served this unbelievable creamy kind of, I think it was white fish in a shell.
Right.
And it was so delicious that we were, like, fighting over it to, like, lick out the shell.
Was it hot or cold?
It was cold.
And was it in, like, a scallop shell?
It was in a scallop shell.
And what was the consistency?
It was pretty smooth, but it did have some good distinctive chunks of, I don't know if it was whitefish. Maybe it was scallops.
Was it like, almost like you would, I don't want to be insulting to it, but almost like a sense of tuna fish salad, that you sense there was something creamy mixed with bits of fish and seasoning?
Well, yes. Although the ratio of creaminess would, I would say, be a little bit more than in a tuna fish salad.
So you could have used
which
this.
Which made it so heavenly.
You could have used this as a spread almost.
Yes.
All right, there's a couple of things this could be. This could be, you know, one of the things where this particular restaurant made this dish, and it's
yes.
not. There is a traditional dish that you find in many forms all over the Mediterranean, and it's done with salt cod. The salt cod is soaked and soaked and soaked for about 3 days, and then it's gently poached,
and it's
flaked. It's flaked out, and then you mix it with mashed potatoes.
And that's brandade, is that right?
Brandade, exactly,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And whipped with olive oil.
Okay.
And
it's funny because I grew up with Jewish breakfast, and so when I saw it, I was like, uh-oh, whitefish salad. But it
right.
did not have that same
quality.
Like, I've wondered if it was a fresh ricotta or a,
it could be a form of brandade done with a combination of milk or cream.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and the olive oil or just milk or cream.
Okay.
That's number one. And brandade recipes, you know, you can find all over the place, and boy, are they good.
Yeah.
The other thing it might be, this is not particularly Tuscan, but we're not saying these people were doing everything traditionally.
Right.
Is something called a tonnato sauce. And this is used to be used over veal and over chicken. But the reality is I've used it as a dip. I've used it as a spread. And what this is olive oil packed tuna.
Uh-huh.
Okay. That is beaten or pureed with homemade mayonnaise and a bit of lemon and garlic. And sometimes it has fresh herbs in it. It may have, you know, flat leaf parsley in it. It would have a bit of onion in it. And this, the tuna taste is there, but it's a very rich taste.
Okay.
And that idea people also use with fresh fish.
Right.
So they may take, you know, fresh cod, they may take fresh bass, whatever, and do that same thing with a homemade mayonnaise. And mayonnaise is used in Italy. It's not used a lot, but it is used. And it would be something that would be sound a little bit like what you might have had. And then since it was in a scallop shell, what I'm wondering is, were cut up, lightly poached scallops worked into this? It may have been a combination of two different things, a flaky fish and then the bits of scallop.
I know. I asked my mother what she recalled about it, and that's the first thing she said. So
I
don't know.
I wish I could tell you more. I'm searching my brain for traditional Tuscan dishes that might fill the bill, and I know as soon as everyone hears this call, we'll get a flood of emails saying, oh, come on, you didn't know about X.
Well, that will be great. I'll check the boards. And maybe the tonnato approach is the way to go.
It may be the way to go.
But
the other thing is, if you can get a hold of salt cod, that brandade is a fabulous thing to have in the summer.
Come on, I'm in Portland. I'm sure I can find some.
You
salt
can
cod
find you. Yeah. Hey, Jane, I'm sorry. I wish I could be more specific.
No, that's a great start. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
800-537-5252. Call us. We have Colette from Madison, Wisconsin on the line. Colette, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, about 2 years ago, I got a sourdough starter for Christmas. And the legend
what a great
behind
gift.
It, I know, you know. The legend behind it goes that the original starter that I came from was about 80 years old. So we're talking pretty prolific thing here.
This thing is alive and multiplying. Yeah.
Right. So, like, when you make it, if you are stupid enough to put it on the counter for a couple of hours, it usually goes over.
brother.
So the thing is, though, it makes really tall breads. Really, it rises really well, but it doesn't have that good sourdough taste. It's not tangy at all. So I'm wondering, like, what I can do to it to kind of make it taste good.
Mm. Okay. Are you saying it's basically pretty flavorless or just that it doesn't have that specific sourness you're looking for?
I would say it's pretty flavorless. Like, it really doesn't have sourness at all.
Uh-huh. Because, you know, every type of, in quotes, sourdough is – there are different types and some are they're all made from different yeasts. Mm-hmm. And those yeasts will have different flavor profiles. So you may not have a sourdough that is sour.
Okay.
You may have a sourdough that comes from a family of yeasts that are quite mild or delicate. Now, one of the things that you can do, how often do you feed this thing?
Once a week.
If you do take, you could take a small part of that, feed it, and put it in a big bowl and leave it out on the counter.
Okay.
Because that may help certain bacteria go to work that will help it sour a bit. You know, the sour, as you well know, is not rotten. It's not – if it smells bad, just toss that part of the sourdough.
Right.
But it can have that tangy kind of quality in the aroma, and that'll tell you. And by the way, there's no reason why you can't taste it.
All right.
You know, just take a little bit and taste it and say, I think this is the beginning. So take a bit of this. Try adding a bit more water and flour. What kind of flour are you using generally?
I'm using King Arthur bread flour.
Okay, that's great. Again, there are all different kinds of yeasts out there.
Okay.
All different kinds of yeast. But try leaving it on the counter overnight, maybe for about 24 hours or so. And see what you get. And if it seems to be starting to get more interesting in flavor, just leave it out a little bit longer.
All right.
And see what you end up with. Don't do this with all of it. Just do it with a part of it.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
All right. And you'll pick up maybe some wild yeast from around your house.
Sounds good.
Okay, Colette. Good luck with it.
Thanks so much.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. 800-537-5252. Who is waiting patiently? Marion's calling from Southern Pines, North Carolina. Marion, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hi, Lynn. You know, I fell in love with raspberries years ago, but, you know, they were very pricey, and
I just had
them with chocolate or something.
Uh-huh.
But now they're very available and very affordable, and I wondered if you could help me with some ideas about recipes for, say, raspberries with, say, chicken or seafood or something like that. Do you?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about raspberries that I like is that they're sweet and they're acidic.
Yes.
Because when a fruit is very, very sweet but kind of bland,
mm-hmm.
and you do anything with it, you know, with savories, it kind of just hangs there.
Right.
It does. No, but you know what I mean? It's like,
uh-huh. Sure.
I can't explain it, but it's like somebody who has nothing to contribute to the party, you know, and drags down everybody else.
That's great.
But the beauty of something mm-hmm. like a raspberry mm-hmm. is that it's sweet and it's tart and it's complex.
Yes.
Now, for my money, I don't want to cook it into things. Because I think when you cook fruit, I mean, you could cook it to the point where it's almost jammy. And then you
yes.
could do that with wine or with a little bit of vinegar or whatever and do it into the sauce. And that's delicious. But I love the idea of the brightness of that very fresh fruit. So the idea would be that it wouldn't be a bad idea to do your grilled chicken or your grilled fish or even, you know, a summer stew. You know, where maybe you take either seafood or something light like poultry and you layer it in a pot with all kinds of fresh vegetables and you put it on the grill.
Oh,
and you just let it cook, you know, with a little mm-hmm. bit of water and you get this very mm-hmm. delicate kind of flavor. And then mm-hmm. sprinkle raspberries over the top of it or just sprinkle the raspberries over the top of the grilled food. And especially if you've used herbs in it like thyme or rosemary or basil.
Okay.
You see, those flavors work beautifully with something like a raspberry flavor.
Well, Lynn, that's a wonderful
idea.
I mean, to think about that stew. I never would have had that idea, so I thank you for your idea.
Now, the other thing you can do, get
yeah.
some decent-tasting white wine vinegar.
Okay.
And crush the raspberries into it, and at the last moment, you just spoon that mixture over anything that you've cooked. Anything, but especially anything that's brown and crusty.
Okay.
Like a pork chop.
Ooh, yes.
Yeah. It just leaps at you.
Yes.
And if
yes.
you were to put a shot of hot chili in there, just a shot,
hot chili. Mm-hmm.
You would like it a lot.
Well, I sure will. Well, thank you so much. Come to visit us sometime.
Oh, I love North
Come
Carolina.
South. All right. Well, thank you again. I'll keep listening.
Okay.
Take special care.
And thank you. You too.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. This idea of berries, don't do too much to them, okay? You know, keep that fruit fairly straightforward. You can call us. We can talk to you, and you can talk to us. 800-537-5252. A question. What can stick relentlessly to non-stick Teflon? Well, believe it or not, shellfish. Dr. Jonathan Wilker is Associate Professor of Bioinorganic Chemistry at Purdue University, and he joins us. Dr. Wilker, welcome.
Nice to be here. Thanks very much.
Okay, so what's so important about the fact that shellfish can stick to Teflon?
Well, I guess you could look at it from various aspects, but one is it's just fascinating, right? Just that in itself is pretty neat, and we want to understand how biology makes materials and how it can stick to surfaces and, mm-hmm. and do that kind of thing. But there's a lot of practical applications you can imagine quite easily that would come from such knowledge. So, for instance, if we know how mussels or oysters or barnacles or things like that can stick to surfaces in wet environments, which is not so easy, mm-hmm. Maybe we could make something like, say, a surgical adhesive, which would be kind of neat. And there aren't really any good surgical adhesives available. Another thing that come from it that would be kind of interesting is if you know how these things can stick to surfaces, maybe you can then make surfaces that they do not stick to, and you can keep, say, ship hulls clean and not have to use extra fuel to push ships through the water and such.
Now, I must confess, I always thought that those animals stuck by suction.
Right, right. There are a few that do, and actually, in fact, there's some. Like the limpet is pretty interesting because the limpet sometimes uses a suction cup, but then sometimes uses adhesive. But when you think of things like mussels, barnacles, oysters, uh-huh. a lot of algae and seaweed and stuff like that, it's all through actually making adhesive or cement, actually a material that they're using.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about the mussels. They have that beard on them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is that what is the adhesive?
That's actually part of it, right. So if you go to a beach and you, say, pull a mussel off of a rock, or if mm-hmm. you just get a bag of mussels and say you want to cook them or something, and
right.
In there, you'll very often see the beard. And so for people who aren't familiar with this, basically you have the whole animal, the shell, and out of one of the sides, you see a whole bunch of threads sticking out. It really looks like hair, like a sort of a dark blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the animals stick themselves to a surface is they put a little dab of adhesive onto the surface, and then they string a thread to connect that adhesive disc to the rest of the animal. And they'll do this, you know, 20 or 40 or 50 times. And so the beard is basically a whole collection of these threads.
Wow.
So at one end of the thread, you have the glue, and at the other end, you have the animal.
So how far away are we from this going from your lab to actually being used, you know, in my doctor's office?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'd hesitate to put sort of a specific date on it, but mm-hmm. I can tell you that we're getting there. We definitely have some very exciting progress. So if you think about what you need in, say, a surgical adhesive, right, you need it to obviously bond very strongly. The sea animals can do that. You need it to set in a wet environment. They do that great.
Mm-hmm.
And you need it to be biocompatible or not toxic. And one of the problems in using the material from the animal straight into, say, you know, surgical setting is mm-hmm. that you just can't get a lot of it. If you see the little adhesive discs on the end of those threads, there's very, very tiny amount of material there. So it's hard to get a lot of it
yeah.
enough to use. And so actually one of the things we're doing in our lab is we're trying to make synthetic versions. And when we make one of these synthetic versions, we can make it 1,000 times more than we could just collect from the animals, like mm-hmm. say in a day. And so what we have so far is stuff that does some similar chemistry. It sticks when it's wet. It sticks very, very strongly. We don't know about the biocompatibility yet, but we're definitely making progress. So it's something that at least I'm very excited about, and I think it looks really encouraging. So I can't really put an exact date on it, but
yeah.
We're hoping. We're really hoping.
Well, Dr. Wilker, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Jonathan Wilker is Associate Professor of Bioinorganic Chemistry at Purdue University. Well, that's the show for this week.
Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Fran Lebowitz. She said, even when freshly washed and relieved of all obvious confections, children tend to be sticky. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends and share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You'll find information on almost everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And hold on, there is so much more on that website. Not only will you find newsletters and podcasts, you can get information on our book, How to Eat Supper, and find our collection of inexpensive recipes to get you cooking in your kitchen. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.